All right, let's get started. This is lesson number 17 in the Baptist Basics University course on the Gospel of John. Our title for the lesson today be Cast the First Stone. I don't know how fitting it is, but it's one of the most memorable quotes from the story. So, but we'll be in the first 11 verses of John chapter 8 today. Once again, I'm Matthew Gage, and I appreciate you taking the time to listen. Hope that we'll be help and blessing to you. Hope that you learn something, be inspired, or just get something out of this. So, now we made it through kind of roughly through John chapter 7, and what was going to take place is this is going to be taking place at the same time, still going to be the Feast of Tabernacles. But what's going to happen here is with the growing opposition with to Christ, there's going to, some people are going to take an opportunity to try to trap him, to try to ensnare him, and try to embarrass him. So with this large crowds that are there at the temple, at this at the Feast of Tabernacles, they're going to take this opportunity to try to set what seems to be a perfect trap. And we're going to deal with this. It really is a brilliant trap that they set. But in the midst of this seemingly perfect trap, Jesus is going to turn it all around on them. And when it seems there's no way out, he really shows they have no way out. So, amazing story. We're going to jump right on into this. I've already talked a little bit about the setting here. This takes place during the Feast of Tabernacles, apparently. So there's still a bunch of crowds. This takes place at the temple. So there's going to be a bunch of people, especially with this bit. The temple is just the center of Jerusalem. It's the center of all everything important to a Jew. It is wrapped up in this temple. I mean, it is their heartbeat of their religion. It's really the symbol of their national identity. What makes a Jew is all wrapped up in this temple. So when all these people have come for the Feast of Tabernacles, they are going to undoubtedly go to the temple. I mean, this was a very special deal. Of course, there's things going on there most of the day. There's going to be people offering sacrifices. You're going to be there's places to give money. There's different offerings that take place throughout the day. So there's always something going on at the temple. If nothing else, I'm sure it was the place to go just because that's where things were happening. Now, with this backdrop, with all these people, Jesus has been very public. He's been teaching. No recorded miracles yet, but he's been teaching. The people are listening. And we've already seen that people are beginning to kind of, there's been some questions and some interaction go on with people. But in the midst of this, the religious leaders are going to set a trap for Christ. And why are they doing it now? Well, there's a bunch of people to embarrass him in front of. If it works, word of mouth is going to spread like wildfire. You probably could get a pretty good mob going. You could discredit Christ, or maybe even have him, killed or lynched. Maybe a good word. I don't know if they lynched people back then, but you probably could get him killed if this all works. So they know exactly what they're doing. So that's what's going to take place here. This is a brilliant trap, and we're going to deal with it here in just a little bit. Okay. In John chapter 8 and verse 1, Jesus went unto the Mount of Olives. Now, it's very interesting that Jesus stays overnight there. There's actually no record in the scriptures of Christ ever staying in Jerusalem overnight. The only real time he did was during the trials before his crucifixion. So he never seemed to stay there. He'd always usually go up. The Mount of Olives seems to be a favorite of his. There was gardens and such there. He would go up there and, I guess, sleep under the stars. But he'd go there, he'd get away from the crowds, get away from danger. But he never, there's no record of him ever spending the night in Jerusalem. Kind of an interesting thing with how critical Jerusalem was to the Jews, and how much of the action of the New Testament takes place in that town. But Jesus evidently never, checked into Motel 6 or stayed with friends. There's no record of them ever staying the night in Jerusalem. Now, it's not to say he didn't. There's just no record of it. So verse 2, and early in the morning he came again into the temple, and all the people came unto him, and he sat down and taught them. Now, this would actually be very convenient because the Mount of Olives is just east of the Temple Mount. So this would have been just a very short walk for him. So he got up early, goes in the temple again. And as soon as the people see him, they all gather around and they're ready for him to teach. Now, it says he sat down and taught them. Now, around parts of the temple, they had porches built. And what these would be some steps, some stone steps going up and kind of a little covered area just around the outer edges of the temple court. Because what you have the temple, you kind of got to see a model of it to kind of maybe understand, so try to explain it. In the heart of it, you had the temple itself, and of course then you had like the altar and stuff in front of it, and all that was surrounded by a fence. And there was one gate on that facing east. And then there was a little courtyard in front of that, basically the same size. I guess you could call that one big fenced-in area. And then there's a little separate one, I believe, right there in the front. Let me flip back here and look at my map and make sure I'm not telling you wrong. But, yes. And then all that, the Temple Mount itself, mostly through the building expansion of Herod the Great, the whole mountaintop was actually raised, in fact. They actually built it up and built some tunnels and stuff underneath it. But they kind of raised it all, flattened it all out, and had this large, large courtyard around it, and which was called the Court of the Gentiles. And this was kind of where you could freely go into that. Almost anybody could go into that area. Now, it was restrictive once you got into the temple to where only male Jews could get into the temple area itself. And then you have the court of the women and stuff like that. Well, this court of the Gentiles, this outer court, had porches built around some of the sides up against the walls and such. And evidently this were teachers and stuff. Now, this also where like the money changers and stuff would have set up shop. But Jesus would have and other teachers evidently would go in these little sit on these porches and sit on the steps or in a seat of some sort, and that way they'd get a little bit higher than the people. People could see them, and they could then teach the people. So Jesus has done this. Evidently, he's climbed up some steps or something. If I'm understanding the architecture and stuff right, some of this we don't know exactly. But anyway, so but I believe he's sitting up in there, and these crowds of people come when they realize he's there. So everybody gathers around. They want to know what he said. What he has to say. So they all come down. He sits down and begins to teach them. Now verse 3. The trap is set. And the scribes and Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. I imagine them being all pompous on that, on the last four words there. Now Moses and the law commanded us that such should be stoned, but what sayest thou? Okay, the rulers there, the scribes who were the most knowledgeable people of the law, then the Pharisees, the most zealous observance of the law, have got this woman taken in adultery, and they say in the very act. So they get her and they bring her to Christ, which is really unusual. You can always tell there's something fishy about this. This shouldn't have been done. This is not the way this would have been handled. The trap is set. So they get this lady, they bring her, there may be a crowd, I don't know, 8 or 10, 20, 30, 40, I don't know how many, but there's a pretty good group of them. They've got a hold of this woman, they come and get right up in the middle of all those people and holler out at Jesus, and they say, you know, Master, which is kind of saying Rabbi, it's just being polite. This woman was taken adultery in the very act, so we caught her red-handed. There's no way possible she should be able to get out. She is guilty, 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 guilty. But then they say, now the law says we should stone her, but what sayest thou? So, in fact, we'll see this in the first part of verse 6. They said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him. Might have to accuse them. Might have to, like they need to. It's have to. That might have something, possess something to accuse him with. I think is what that means there. Like I'd quit saying, you ever get bad habit like that? Well, if you're listening to yourself speak, you'll pick up on something. I gotta quit saying, I apologize for doing that. I need to work on that. Hard habit to break. I may have to slap myself every time I do it or something. Anyway, I got so sidetracked on that. I apologize. So, but the trap is set. So let's look at this. The penalty, according to the Old Testament, was death for both adulterers. So here's another point that maybe something isn't quite right in this situation, is that we only have one participant in adultery here. That is a little bit odd. I'm looking this up. Deuteronomy 22 and verse 22 says, "If a man be found lying with a woman married to an husband, then shall both of them die, both the man that layeth the woman and the woman, so shalt thou put away evil from Israel." So the penalty, the death penalty for adultery, is very valid. You know, they say Moses said without stoner. It's very interesting. Moses didn't say stoner. He said just kill her. Tradition was to stone. So already, you know, they get a little mixed up there. But we have the problem, you know, where was the man? If they really caught her in the act, where's the guy? So very strange. You know, kind of takes two to commit adultery. So there's a lot of strange things about this. They leave some loopholes. They think they've got it all thought out, but there's some little loopholes that they leave. I think they're very interesting. So they got this woman. They bring her. Say, you know, she ought to be stoned. According to Deuteronomy 22:22, she ought to die. So so what's Christ supposed to answer? Well, the way I see it, there's three answers he could give. One would be that he would affirm the Mosaic death penalty, that he'd say, yes, she should die. Let's get some rocks right now and stone her. Now, the problem, that would be very popular with the Jews. The problem is it would break Roman law, because under the Roman jurisdiction and stuff that Israel was under, they couldn't pass the death penalty without Roman approval. That's why when Jesus was tried, he had to be tried by the Romans. The Jews couldn't just go and kill him. They had to get approval by the Romans. And even that was limited to just religious matters. Anything like any kind of a civil matter, the Romans just did themselves. So doing this would be a slap in the face of Rome, and would probably have him tried before Rome as a rebel rouser, and very likely could get himself killed. If nothing else, it would get him out of the way and go a long way in discrediting him, because, I mean, then they could say, well, look, he broke the law. How could he be righteous? So that's the one answer he could give. The second one is he could disregard the Mosaic law, which would discredit him with the Jews. So instead of saying, yes, let's stone her, let's get some rocks right now, he could say, well, now, fellas, now, that was written a long time ago, and, you know, she doesn't look so bad. And, by the way, y'all didn't get the man to. You know, we ought to dismiss this case right now for lack of evidence. If he had done something along those lines, he would really be slapping in the face of the Mosaic law, which is a bad thing to do to the Jews who are so wrapped up in it. If he didn't go by the law, the Jews would think that would think that he was breaking the law, that he was, you know, slapping in the face of their heritage. This would be an insult. This would discredit him almost immediately. If he didn't hold up the law that they cherished, he must not be the Christ. So those are the two pretty obvious answers he could give. Third option he could have had would be to dodge the question, which would make him seem weak, stupid, indecisive. So if he just him and hawed around, if he just played political deal and said he voted for it before he voted against it, or, you know, one of those famous flip-flops. I did it again. But if he had done something like that, it would have made him seem very weak. And listen, you know, one thing people do not like is someone who can't make up their mind. People don't like wishy-washy people. especially in someone they look up to in leadership. They want somebody decisive. So this is really the worst option he could have, I think, of all three, because this would really just be an embarrassment, and he'd lose a lot of credibility. So we'll see what Christ does. Oh, Christ chooses the fourth option, though, one that's not quite so obvious. In the middle of verse 6 there, we'll jump right in. But Jesus stooped down, and with his finger wrote on the ground, as though he heard them not. So instead of just answering them, Jesus, who I think is probably sitting on some like stone steps or something, just leans over and starts writing in the dirt. Now, where did that dirt come from? I don't know. Is it just the dust upon the rocks? You know, I have no idea. So, but there's some dirt there, there's some sand there, and he starts to write in it. Now, there's been a lot of people guess at what he wrote. We have no idea what he wrote. There's some different theories out there. Some say that he wrote down all those people's sins, all these people that brought that woman. Maybe he wrote down what they did. Maybe he wrote down the names of the people they had committed adultery with. I've heard that. So, maybe he wrote something like God wrote in Daniel 5:5, many, many tickle upharsin. Maybe he wrote something like that. That's the only other instance, I guess, other than the Ten Commandments where we have God would be writing. Now, a very interesting verse that, you know, for what it's worth, I don't know how far you can take this. I have to credit Brother Mickey Carter with his sermon on this. That's where I kind of learned about this, was from his sermon. But in Jeremiah 17:13, excuse me, it says, O Lord, the hope of Israel, all that forsake thee shall be ashamed, and they that depart from me shall be written in the earth, because they have forsaken the Lord, the fountain of living waters. So what is maybe being done here is a fulfillment of this prophecy. Of course, now you got to realize these guys were Pharisees and scribes. They knew the law, probably were familiar with this verse, at least somewhat. So when he start writing in the earth, maybe they got and wrote their names in the earth, in the sand there. Maybe they realized that that was them saying that they had forsaken the Lord, that they had departed from God. So that is a possibility. It's an interesting verse. I don't know. I don't know how far you can go with that, but just kind of an interesting, you can throw that around. That's really the closest thing the Bible comes to telling us what they say. I think that probably be your best option if you want to find something in the Bible that says what Jesus wrote. That'd be a very good one to go with, because it's really the only thing it talks about writing in the sand. What he possibly could have wrote would have been their names. And that also would go to explain why they left in the way that they did, because they leave in a certain order. So it wasn't something generic. You know, if he's writing the Ten Commandments, why did they leave? It was the oldest to youngest, I believe, wasn't it? I don't remember now. So, yes, oldest to youngest, verse 9. So, but anyway, no matter what he wrote, it had some power behind it. Of course, everything Christ did had power behind it. So, in verse 7, when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself. So they say, hey, did you hear us? We got a problem here. Aren't you going to answer us? Are you taking the third option? Are you just going to dodge the question? What are you doing? No, we want to know. What do you think? So they continued asking him. He lifted up himself and said unto them, he that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. In verse 8, and he again stooped down and wrote on the ground. So he just went on like he was. You know, it's like I'm not going to be bothered with you guys. I'm just going to keep writing in the sand here. In verse 9, and they which heard him, being convicted by their own conscience, so whatever he heard him say, being without sin, possibly brought about by conviction, most probably brought conviction by whatever he wrote in the sand. It convicted their own hearts and their own conscience. They went out one by one, beginning at the eldest, even unto the last, and Jesus was left alone, the woman standing in the midst. Okay? Excuse me. So Jesus writes this, they leave oldest, youngest. Something inside each one of those men sparks inside them, and they realize we have no business doing this. They realize that they too are sinners. They become under conviction themselves, so the oldest one leaves. Then the next, then the next, then the next. And finally, there's the little kid that was tagging along left, or whoever it was. Probably wasn't a little kid. Probably was like a teenager, 20-something, you know, college-age kid, I guess. But anyway, they all just turn tail and leave. And we see that finally they all leave, leaving just Jesus and this woman in the midst. Now, this is very important. When you see this dramatized a lot of times, it's like Jesus and the woman are left alone. That didn't take place. This is right in the middle of the temple. There's throngs of people. The only people that left were these accusers. So this woman is still standing around there, and all these people are looking at Jesus and looking at her, thinking, okay, what's going to happen now? Can you imagine how awkward this is? She's still standing there, but there's no one left to accuse her. In verse 10, when Jesus had lifted up himself and saw none but the woman, he said unto her, Woman, where are those thine accusers? Hath no man condemned thee? She said, No man, Lord. And Jesus said to her, Neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. So Jesus raises up. All those men are gone. He got rid of them. She's the only one left standing there. And Jesus says, you know, where are they? She says, no, they're gone. And so she says, well, and Jesus says, well, I don't condemn you either. Go and sin no more. Now, Jesus uses that phrase quite a bit. Listen, sin in the Bible, there's a couple different connotations you can go to with it, okay? A couple different definitions. One of them, sin is just the very act of disobeying God's law. It's when we do wrong, when we do evil, when we disobey God's commands. That's sin. Now, the other way you can go with it is saying that sin is more of a lifestyle. And that's really when you see the word sinner most of the time in the Bible. It's not just saying, oh, somebody who sins, and therefore everybody's a sinner. That's very true. But it also can go into, when you, especially in the Gospels, when it talks about a sinner, it's talking about a very wicked person, a non-religious person, a person who is a secular person, a person who has no concern for God or holy things. And I think what Jesus is saying here is not just, hey, go and live a perfect life. What he's saying here is go and don't get back into that lifestyle. It's like you've been given a new shot at life. Take advantage of it. I believe that's what he's telling her in that. Because, of course, it's impossible for us to live a perfect life. I've said a lot, and I may have said in this course, when I was a young boy, I'd decide one time I wanted to be perfect. And I was going to try to be perfect all day long. And I made it to about the middle of the afternoon or the early evening, and my sister made me mad, and I just had to hit her. And I made it that long, though, or at least I thought I did. But, you know, no matter how hard we try, that's a bad example, you know, hitting your sister. Don't do that. But, you know, it's a very, very bad example. But it just goes to show, no matter how hard we try to be good, no matter how hard we try to follow God's law, we still fall. We still falter. So I don't think he was telling her to go live a sinless life. That's impossible. Us humans, we can't do it. But what he's telling her is go and avoid that evil, wicked lifestyle. Go and live a righteous life. I think that's what he's telling her. Now, I usually haven't spent a lot of time summarizing these lessons. I think this one needs a few points brought out to kind of wrap it up. Because there's some very controversial things in this chapter. First thing, of course, is that Jesus was not going to be taken into the trap. You can't trick God. God knows more than you do. God's smarter than you are. You're not going to trick God. So don't you even get that in your mind like, well, I really want this, but I can trick God, you know. It's like, you know, I almost envision a young lady saying, well, I really want to marry him, but and I really want God's blessing on it, so he wants to be a missionary. I'll be a missionary too, you know, just because I want to marry him. Well, sometimes we do that. Like, okay, well, God, you know, I need a little help with my, or you're praying and you're like, God, I need some more money. Now, you remember, I gave that extra $20 last week. We all do that at times. It's so stupid, but we tend to do that at times. We'll try to make deals with God or try to use leverage with God. We try to basically be smarter than God. Now, listen, God's bigger than us. If we could figure out God, he'd be less than us. We can't figure out God. God's bigger than we are. God's smarter than we are. God knows everything. There's no limit to his knowledge, to his wisdom. So don't fall into that trap itself. Now, let me also say that Jesus in no way condones adultery. They say that in some early manuscripts of the Bible that this story is missing because they thought it would lead to people living an immoral lifestyle and saying that Jesus allowed it. Well, no, that's not the case. Jesus in no way is condoning or promoting or allowing adultery. Just as he would with any sin. He's not allowing it. He's not condoning it. He's not promoting it. But what he is doing is giving the sinner a second chance. That's what Jesus is about. Another lesson we can take from this is that we should be more worried about our own problems than others' problems. These guys were so wrapped up that this woman had broken the law. This woman had committed adultery. Ah, it's so evil, so bad. She's so wicked. It's like she's going to catch on fire from hell at any moment. When those guys were sinners too. They just had a different set of problems. Boy, be careful judging. Be careful, careful, careful judging. We always minimize our own problems and always maximize the other problems, other people's problems. We also tend to overlook some of theirs and our, we try to measure up amongst them. Well, I'm better than he is because I do this and he does that and I don't do this and he doesn't do that. And we try to measure up. It's impossible. It's fallible because we're horrible judges of ourselves. And we're pretty bad judges of other people, too, because we don't know them. We really don't know everything about them. So, next time you want to be critical of somebody, why don't you mind your own business? Why don't you straighten your own life about? We'd get a whole lot more done if we quit worrying about other people's problems and focused on our own. And the last thing I want to say is that Jesus' mission was to save, not to condemn. Jesus' mission was to save, not to condemn. In John chapter 3, verse 17, "For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved." Here was a case where the righteous God of the universe could have looked down and said, "You, woman, are a sinner. You should be punished. You should go straight to hell right now." And the great God of the universe would have had every right to do so, but he didn't. Why? Because Jesus is not here to condemn us. Jesus is not here to send people to hell. Jesus is here to prevent us from going there. In the midst of all this, this trap where this woman was just an unwilling pawn in this scheme that the Pharisees had cooked up, Jesus not only turns the tables on the Pharisees, he takes the time to give this woman a second chance. That shows his care. Jesus didn't just go after his enemies. He took care of this lady that was involved in this. Jesus was not there to condemn her. Jesus was there to save her. Listen, thank God Christ isn't out to condemn us. There's plenty he could condemn us for. But Christ is here to, Christ came to save us. He didn't die so that some people could go to hell. He died so that we could go to heaven. Jesus wants to save everybody, no matter what their sin, no matter how wicked they may seem. We're all wicked before the sight of God. We're all sinners. We all fall short. And Jesus can save them just like he saved you. Or maybe you were that person that everybody thought was a hopeless cause. Praise God, Christ can save anyone. There's no limit to the power of his blood. There's no limit to the mighty works of God. It's an amazing story, amazing and very familiar story. There's so much there and some stuff I really wish I could get a little bit further into, but we're going to keep it to a manageable about 30 minutes here. Boy, I get to rambling. I really thought I hadn't been going but 15 or 20 minutes on that. But anyway, I appreciate you listening to this lesson and hope to catch you on the next one. Thank you very much.